Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cedarstrom. I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for December 7th, 2023. And yes, that is a Thursday. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Melody. Happy National Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day. Yeah, each year, Remembrance Day honors all those who lost their lives when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, a day that has indeed lived in infamy. More than 3,500 Americans lost their lives or were wounded on that solemn day, and as a result, the attack forced the U.S. into a war that had already been raging for 2 years and would last about four more. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yes, it is. So, well, I guess we can talk a little bit about gold today. That might be in the history books pretty soon. We have a little bit of recovery, not much, but $3 today at $2,029. Silver was down 9 pennies at $23.88. Platinum was up 20, 918, with palladium up 27, 996. The USDX today is down 0.61 at 103.55. And crude oil was up 29 at 69.67. And the paper markets today, you've got the NASDAQ was up over 1%, but the Dow was up 62 points. The S&P was up 36 points, and the NASDAQ was up 193. And the European markets were all negative across the board, although percentage-wise, I don't think any of them were higher than a quarter of a percent. So Asia, pretty much the same type of trading. The Nikkei was down 1.75%. 10-year yield, 4.14. And natural gas today was down another 0.16% at 2.56. So that's pretty much it in the market report today. We do have jobless claims Thursday, and I don't know why we're talking about the first thing. Usually you've been saving it for the last thing for the segment.
I know. It just goes to show what kind of news day it is out there today.
Yeah, that's true. That's really true. There is an interesting one that I hope we're going to talk about today. But jobless claims Thursday. Applications for jobless benefits ticked up last week. But the overall number of people in the U.S. collecting unemployment benefits fell after hitting its highest level in 2 years last week. Unemployment benefit claims rose by 1,000 to 220,000 for the week ending December 2nd. And it's pretty much what everyone was expecting. About 1.86 million were collecting unemployment benefits the week that ended November 25th. And is the second time in 11 weeks that continuing claims have fallen. Let's see. What else is there, Dave?
Well, it does. I mean, hiring's definitely slowing down now from the pace of in 2021 and 2022. Employers added 606,000 jobs a month in 2021 and about 400K per month last year. And now over the last 5 months, these gains have slipped to an average of about 190,000 a month, down from an average of 287K in the first 5 months of the year. And analysts are predicting that private non-farm job gains will come in around 173,000 tomorrow when the government issues its November jobs report. That's pretty much it, Melody.
And this is really no big surprise. You got this year, the year 2023 was the least affordable year for home buying in the last 11 years. This was a report that was released today by Redfin, which is a real estate company. And in 2023, someone making the median income in the U.S., $78,000, would have had to spend more than 40% of their income on monthly housing costs if they bought the median priced home, which was around $400,000. So they started making these records back in 2012, which makes it for this year up nearly 3 percentage points from last. Monthly costs for home buyers, that increased more than twice as fast as wages. 30-year fix, we know it hit 8% in October, and that was the first time since 2000, from the year 2000. So if you wanted to spend a maximum of 30% of your income on monthly housing payments for a median-priced home, you would have to have earned a minimum income of about 110,000. It's not, I don't know how many people out there are making 110 grand a year.
Well, they're certainly below the national median. Now that record high is up 8.5% for just last year and 30,000 more than the typical household income. Austin, Texas, the only larger city that became more affordable last year, decreasing by about 1%. Meanwhile, most expensive metros, predictably, many in California, like Anaheim, outside of L.A., San Francisco, and San Jose. A lot of people in those areas, they say, were forced to rent last year due to the high housing purchase costs. On the other end, Midwest metros, again, proving to be among the most affordable. Again, as we've been seeing throughout most of this year, someone in Detroit making the median income only spent around 18% of their earnings on monthly housing costs. That area. Now, interestingly, Redfin seeing mortgage rates falling to about 6.6% in 2024. And prices dropping a measly 1% as new listings find their way into the marketplace.
Let's see. It's kind of interesting because I think there's so much more to it than of this, but the Biden administration is putting pharmaceutical companies on a notice, warning them that if the price of certain drugs is too high, the government might cancel their patent protection and allow rivals to make their own versions. I don't know how that can be done. I mean, you would think that that's, you know.
Well, I thought under federal law, I mean, patents were good for X amount of years. Now, I don't know, maybe he's getting advice from some of his lawyers saying you as president have some ability, or maybe it's another agency has some, I don't know if the patent agency has any kind of flexibility for that.
Yeah,
but they must, if, you know, otherwise, why would they? I mean, Big Pharma is loaded with legal experts and lobbyists. Can't imagine they'd be rolling out this warning if they thought they couldn't do it.
They did that about the tuition, the loans, student loans.
Well, that's, you know, that's,
but they do it anyway, and it's just true. They're just idle threats. But what's interesting is I saw a report today, though, because we know where the majority of our medications come from or are made, China. And now we're short. Now we're having shortages, and we've been talking about this for, I don't know, the last couple of years a lot. You know, we've seen so many of these shortages come, and knowing that, 80, 90% of our pharmaceuticals are made in China? I mean, that's, even if it's 50%. And you have these life-saving medications. They're the headline was a little girl with leukemia faces 15-month wait for a life-saving medication that just costs $10. So the problem is a whole lot deeper than just what the pharmaceuticals, what they charge, what we pay for medications. And the American Cancer Society survey found 1 in 10 patients have been affected by shortages, forcing them to use substitute drugs or delay treatment. So there's some, you never hear anybody addressing that issue, though, Dave. Anyone?
Yeah, shortages of particularly these cancer treatment drugs is a big problem, a threat to the health and life of those affected. You would think that there's more more pushback from the White House to get these things going. Now, you know, some of them, you know, like the newer weight loss drugs like Ozempic, we're reading more and more that, you know, while originally intended for people with certain diseases like diabetes and other issues, that they're now just being used, and apparently the supply being overly burdened by people who are convincing their doctors to write scripts just because they're overweight, without any, you know, underlying health issues. It would be nice, certainly, you know, I think good for the country if we were a healthier nation, a healthier world. Boy, come on, there has to be some kind of prioritization here. Again, I don't know how pharmacies can know that, because you know, the prescribing doctors are, I'm sure, use similar, if not the same, kind of diagnosis codes to get insurance company approval. But anyway.
You know, well, again, I mean, it's a bigger problem. The insurance companies are a problem. And, you know, the whole system is a problem and it's not working well. And it's this is just another part of that system that's not working well. I mean, if you look at what we pay for pharmaceuticals versus everywhere else in the world, it's like, you know what? Well, maybe if they just, but again, how do you force a company to adjust their pricing in other countries? I mean, we don't make this stuff here. They have us over locked stock and barrel, so to speak. So I don't know. I don't know what the solution is. Start making the items back here, but a lot of those raw materials and so forth comes from overseas. And we've seen supply chains. We've talked about the Panama Canal. We've talked about, how that could delay items coming to this country and everything. So it's not working. The systems are breaking. In my view, they're breaking down. And so,
meanwhile, since it's going to take a long time to unwind what ails us, in that sense, I'm all for any kind of actions like this that could result in lower out-of-pocket expenses for Americans, especially sicker ones.
And again, inflation is also part of the problem, but there was a lot of criticism is growing on a paper that was released earlier this week. I believe you discussed it on Tuesday's show, claims some investors may have profited on advanced knowledge of the Hamas's attack on Israel on the 7th of October. And this is a paper that was done by two law professors and one former SEC commissioner. And so a few days in, there's pushback on both the details and the broad claims the two law professors made. Israeli security regulators publicly said that they looked into any suspicious trading in Israel ahead of the attacks. And of course, they found nothing. Did you think that they really would? But found nothing abnormal that requires further investigation. Nope, nip it in the bud. Separately, officials from Israel's Tel Aviv Stock Exchange pointing out that the potential profits to the TASE trades that the paper spotlighted were magnified by an order of 100 due to an error related to the denomination of stocks. Stocks in Israel are priced in. What are they priced in?
We'll call them Israeli pennies.
Israeli pennies rather than shekels. And the authors acknowledged the error and revised the paper, but they say the core findings that there were large, unusual short positions taken in the U.S. Listed MSCI Israel ETF ahead of the attack. And so there you have it.
Well, the one thing that stuck out in my mind is that their key finding is that these shorts surged to nearly 100% of all trading volume on October 2nd, just 5 days before the Hamas attack. I'm sure there's going to be some continuing investigation. Unless there was some really questionable insider trading among Israeli officials. Of course, we'll do whatever they can to protect themselves. But, there's some skeptics that look at this kind of stuff all the time. And they think that these large short positions were just a coincidence in terms of the timing. That they weren't even an anomaly. I don't know. You look at 100% of a day's trading volume on any exchange, I don't care how big or small, that raises an eyebrow. So it turns out, this might not have been Hamas tipsters driving the trade activity, but rather good old-fashioned month and quarter-end trading dynamics. which was September 30th, by the way.
Well, you know, there's lots of information being reduced too. You can argue both sides where everyone, the Israeli knew, not everyone, but they knew that the attacks were coming. So why wouldn't they make investment decisions? And
yeah,
I hear the music. That means we're heading into a break. Yes, we'll be right back. Please stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSCTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home. And if you ask me how I'm feeling, don't tell me you're too blind to see. Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down, never gonna run around and desert you, never gonna make you cry, never gonna say goodbye, never gonna tell a lie and hurt you, never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. 1-800-375-4188 is Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. Visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com, and make sure you sign up for our weekly newsletter. And I think we pretty much concluded about the Hamas and the driving the trade activity prior to the attack.
Yeah.
Yes. And this is kind of interesting. You have, Bitcoin has been going gangbusters. And remind me, Dave, I want to ask you to check something on me on Bitcoin. Remind me at break.
Okay.
And I'm not a fan of Elizabeth Warren. I'm not a fan of Jamie Dimon. But, in this case, Warren had said at this week's Senate Banking Committee to note that criminals are using the financial system to move money to finance terrorists, drug traffickers, and sanctioned countries using crypto. And, Dave, I say that a lot to people who support cryptos. I said the reason I don't, because it's used on the dark web. What does the dark web support? Pornography, kidnappings, child pornography, drugs, money laundering, Terrorists? Why would I want to support anything like that? And
it's an important question. That's not rhetorical by any stretch. And it's something, particularly any new investor, someone contemplating an initial investment, ought to think about. Is it just the ends justifies the means? Hey, I'm just going to dump my $1,000 or $10,000 into Bitcoin and going to make my quick profit and get out, in and out. Just I have a younger, well, I'll call him an acquaintance, who I've done some jobs with over the last 15 years, is much younger than I am, is in his 30s. And he took some of his early savings, the first Bitcoin craze, I think it's like $5,000. It might have even been three now that I recall. But he made a ton of money. He ended up with Bitcoin in the low 100,000. But you figure a return on investment like that.
Yeah.
He got out and he's using the proceeds to travel around the world with his, I think it's a girlfriend. I don't think he's married, but anyway, all about the money.
Do I know him?
I don't believe so. Possible.
Oh, I'm intrigued.
I'll tell you offline to protect the guilty.
Let's go ahead and talk about mortgage rates. We know that they've been coming down along with the 10-year yield. So we have the 30-year mortgage that dropped to 7% from 7.22% just last week. And from a year ago, the rate was 10% lower. The last time the average rate was lower was in early August when it was at 6.96%. Borrowing costs on the 15-year fixed rate mortgages, which is popular with the homeowners refinancing their home loans, that declined also this week, with the average rate falling to 6.29% from 6.56 last week. A year ago, it was 5.67, so it's still a little higher. Now, this is the sixth straight weekly drop for rates, and echoing the pullback, as I mentioned, in the 10-year Treasury yield. And the reason we tell you about the 10-year Treasury yield, because that's the one lenders use as a guide when they're pricing loans. And we saw the yield in mid-October surge to its highest level since 2007. So I don't know. The average rate on a 30-year home loan climbed above 6% in September last year, and it's remained above that threshold since. And, of course, again, as I mentioned, it reached 8 in October, Dave.
Well, the downward movement in mortgage rates, certainly a welcome development, especially for young prospective home buyers who face a housing market that is still largely unaffordable for many Americans. Now, while the sale of previously occupied homes here are down over 20% this year so far, home prices keep climbing, and that's largely a function of a continuing low supply of properties in the market. So we'll see what happens. I mean, 2 years ago, remember, 30-year mortgage was 3.1%. Now, quickly things can change. Now, the pullback in rates has spurred pickup and demand for home loans. Mortgage applications notched their fifth consecutive weekly increase last week, according to the Mortgage Bankers.
Okay, let's see. What else do we have next, Dave?
Well, you got the IMF, International Monetary Fund, and other thought process leaders, as they're called in the elitist world. I've been at a Council on Foreign Relations event yesterday and the day before, and they're talking about how many economic powers, including the U.S., have begun turning inward. Trend we saw up in pace, especially in the early part of the pandemic and throughout, efforts to boost domestic industries, for example, manufacturing here in the States. But these IMFers and other elites are saying, I guess they're warning, that a shift away from globalization poses some big questions for this new normal that we're heading into. Now, pardon me, IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva said, during the highs of globalization, we were a bit too complacent. True. So we have to accept that there had to be a course correction, which she says could be healthy, but we have to do it the right way. She said, what worries us is that we're not quite yet seeing and understanding that in a world of more frequent shocks, the only way to build resilience is to work more together. I did the slowdown in trade, as well as growing restrictions around the world. We know that when trade doesn't grow, that has implications, right? Noting that, well, whether they're supply side snafus, too many tariffs, whatever, trade fragmentation causes a contraction in global GDP growth. And obviously, there are many other factors at play, too. It's an interesting take. I think just from a broad perspective, you know, as more and more nations, industrialized especially, are starting or wanting to become more self-reliant, it does pose some interesting questions. I mean, we see it in recent predictions of, say, China's growth in the coming years, down somewhat, if not significantly, from where they were in the past decade, now averaging 6-8% a year, which, granted, is a lot easier to do when your cumulative or your aggregate GDP is much smaller than, say, the U.S.'s 25 trillion dollars. I think it's a little higher than that, but anyway, I just found that sense of this particular story interesting.
Well, I think what it does is it tells you just how entwined we are with the rest of the world.
Yeah,
and
good
that
point.
To me, that is the problem. And we did lose something when they connected the world and pushed through globalization without protecting so much that the United States have in order to complete their little globalization for their wealth and for their power. And so now we're seeing it break up because, you know what? Doesn't work, because I think these countries are realizing it, and you know, we are looking, countries need to take care of themselves first. So it is being fractured, it is fracturing, and perhaps it's coming apart. So I don't know where it goes from here, but you know, look at these countries, look at the conditions, look at the wars. You know, now we're looking at Venezuela starting a war, and the U.S. is going to be right right in the middle of it. And so,
yeah, I think we're too the world's too interdependent as a whole. And then that, I mean, mm-hmm. there ought to be some exceptions to that in our own self-interest from a national security or economic standpoint, like decoupling Russia from the global scene, and even being more targeted in our relationship with China. Now that's a little more difficult because of how much they've grown, but still, I think
which is not a good thing because they've grown at our expense. That's the problem. These countries have grown at our expense.
Yeah, well, that's what some have argued that you know, on the one hand, Kissinger and Nixon had so much credit for
destroying,
introducing, you know, the U.S. to China and vice versa, and sort of opening that the sleeping giant, as it turns out, to world commerce. And you know, the bigger
they all did, yeah, they all did it.
The bigger it got, the more countries wanted to trade with it, and now we've got China as a world military force that needs to be reckoned with, and
stopping them.
Well, yeah, too late now.
Too late now. I've been having conversations about how when them building their military, and you know, it's. So we knew it was happening. People knew it was happening, but there isn't anybody in the D.C. area that has the spine to stop it, because everybody gets wealthy off of it. Bank of Japan, are they ending the negative rates?
No.
And that's going to be a really big issue to their major economic counterparts. But there's new hints out of Tokyo saying that they may be on the verge of ending. There was a speech yesterday by the Bank of Japan's deputy governor, followed by comments from Governor Uda to Parliament at a meeting with the prime minister today, led traders to believe that a rate hike could come as early as December 19th at the BOJ meeting. We saw the yen soar 2% against the dollar, and that actually set a 3-year high. Japanese interest rates have been a negative 0.1% since 2016, Dave.
Yeah, I suspect that had a lot to do with the Nikkei's almost 2% drop today. traders, they're not responding too well to the prospects of higher interest rates. Although in the long run, overall, it seems that would be better for their economy. But so it'll be interesting. Question is, how and when will Japan exit the negative rate world? And how much will that affect their economy? It's something we're going to have to wait and see. Deputy Bank of Japan Governor Ryozo Hamino said that if this is done properly, there would be a sufficient possibility of achieving a positive outcome from the exit. It's all Fed speak in another language.
It's true. Very true. Absolutely. Make us all feel warm and fuzzy.
Ah, yes.
And here's another one. It's Russia, Russia, Russia. The UK accused Russia today of conducting years-long campaign of malicious cyber activity. Like they were the only ones in the world. Every country in this, on the planet, I'm sure, has some sort of a campaign of malicious cyber activity. But they're saying Russia's using theirs against politicians, civil servants, journalists, undermining the British democracy. Maybe it's the British government also that's undermining their democracy. But anyway, Britain's National Cyber Security Center The country's intelligence agency, which is part of the GCHQ, said in a report that Russian spies had been running the cyber campaign against these high-profile British individuals and entities since at least 2015 through to this year. And we can finish this up when we get back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Yes, sirree, that love affair. Boy, one more time today. Welcome back to Financial Survival. Brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, losing my voice as we speak. Melody taking care of other client business. This final segment, you know how to reach her, 1-800-375-4188. Hey, a year after a cap on Russian oil prices was imposed, the Treasury Department says that more enforcement's needed to counteract Moscow's growing ability to ship crude. The $60 price cap on Russian crude oil was credited last year with actually making a dent in how much cash the Kremlin brings in from oil sales. That money helps pay for its war in Ukraine. Russian crude prices on global markets rose to about $80 a barrel in September and October before settling down. That was driven by both higher oil prices at the time, as well as Russia's investment in its so-called shadow fleet of ships to carry its oil and avoid the rules that underpin this price cap. A recent report from the Atlantic Council showed that about 70% of Russian oil shipping is now conducted by this shadow fleet, compared with under 30% in January last year. Wally Adeyemo, who's a deputy treasury secretary, says Russia invested in new shipping capacity that operates without coalition services, creating more capacity for oil exports priced above the cap. This memo was sent to his counterparts in the coalition of G7 nations and Australia put together this cap. He added that we have to adjust our approach to account for the new dynamic. Now, this price cap plan was based on the fact that several service providers like shippers and insurers, which is the traditional backbone of the global oil market, are almost entirely based in the West and subject to Western financial regulations. Basically, shippers and their insurers are required to get assurances from those buying and moving the oil that the petroleum was sold below $60. Violations open those companies to potential criminal and civil penalties. But for much of last year, apparently it was little in the way of public enforcement. However, the government seems to be signaling that that's going to change. In recent weeks, there's been increased enforcement activity with sanctions levied on several shippers following a handful announced earlier this month. Adeyemo said, too, that we have to reduce Russia's profits by strengthening enforcement for the continued trade of Russian oil with coalition services and increasing the cost of Russia's efforts to circumvent the cap. Gosh, sorry about my voice, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, the top 1% of American earners now control more wealth than the nation's entire middle class. According to new federal data, more than one quarter of all household wealth, 26.5%, belongs to Americans who earn enough money to rank in the top percentile by income. That's according to Federal Reserve statistics through June of this year. The top 1% still holds about $39 trillion in wealth. That's more than the combined wealth of America's middle class, which is a group that economists defined as, or most do, as the middle 60% of households by income. Those households, as defined, hold about 26%. Low-income Americans, representing the bottom 20% by income, own about just 3% of wealth. Years ago, Americans celebrated middle class commanded twice as much wealth as the upper 1%. Fed data shows that over the years, the rich have steadily grown richer. No surprise, talk about that all the time. The top 1% caught and passed the middle class in collective wealth during the pandemic in late 2020. The wealth lead has changed hands since then, but the 1%ers have it now, and their margin is growing. Who are the top 1% besides, you know, the well-known billionaires, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk? Many are low-profile multimillionaires living quietly among us. Princeton economist Owen Zidar noted, as you go up the wealth distribution, it's more and more these private business owners. A lot of them are boring businesses, auto dealers, beverage distributors, people who own 7-8 Jiffy Lubes. Now, why the rich keep getting richer compared to everyone else is a topic of recurring debate among the nation's economists and everyday Americans. Scott Hoyt, who was a senior guy at Moody's Analytics, said if there were a good answer to that question, I think the policymakers in Washington would be all over it to fix it. Instead of one answer, though, there seem to be several. I mean, look at real estate. The upper 1% controls 13% of real estate wealth this year, up from 8% at the start of 1990. The average home price has more than tripled during that time period. And then there's stocks. The top 1% holds close to half of all corporate equities and mutual fund shares this year. As recently as 2003, their share of equities was below 30%. And owning a private business. The upper 1% owns nearly half, one half of all private company wealth today, up from 30% a little over 30 years ago. Princeton Zadar said people who owned homes, who owned stocks, who owned retirement accounts, they did very well. And a lot of people who don't own homes and a lot of people who don't own stocks, they missed out on that opportunity. Just as economists don't all agree on what's causing the rich to get richer, there's no consensus that the concentration of wealth is bad for the rest of America. I mean, after all, the middle class isn't necessarily getting poorer. They're just not getting richer as fast as the rich. Now, between 1979 and 2021, the wages of Americans in the top 1% grew by 206%. That's after adjusting for inflation. In the same year, or the same time span, wages for the bottom 90% grew by only 29%. Hoyt says if a rising tide is lifting all boats, but just lifting some boats more than others, well, that's one thing, but if the playing field is tipping and some people are getting more wealthy and some are getting less wealthy, that's another story. Nonetheless, many economists and others say the growing concentration of wealth bodes ill for the nation as a whole. Joel Friedman, who chairs the economics department at Brown University, says when people feel like they don't have a chance, or perhaps even more dangerously, when they feel like their kids don't have a chance, that inequality of opportunity is what really gets people upset. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. Zider believes stagnant wealth hinders middle-class Americans from getting a top-drawer education, starting a business, or landing a high-wage job. What then is a middle-class American to do? Middle-income Americans may not have millions of dollars to invest, but they still can reap some of the economic opportunities available to the top 1%. Homeownership, if you can afford it. Middle class still owns about 40% of the nation's real estate. Another strategy is stocks, even though the middle class owns about 12% of all corporate equities and mutual fund shares, that people can build on a 401k or an IRA. And that is a great way to position yourself. Anyway, interesting story there. Last today, if I can make it through this. Pam and Russ Martin's report in today's Wall Street on Parade newsletter that David Solomon, who chairs and is CEO of Goldman Sachs, let it slip at yesterday's Senate Banking Committee hearing in Washington. What's really driving the too big to fail banks' pushback against regulators' proposal to raise capital requirements at banks with more than $100 billion in assets? The Martins tell us that when Solomon was asked about the proposed rules, he answered by trying to justify how the trillions of dollars in derivatives his company is holding inside its federally insured and taxpayer-supported bank is helping the country, and that raising capital requirements on those trades would raise costs to consumers. Well, the Martins say that Solomon's long-winded answer explains the real reason why these Wall Street behemoths are behind probably one of the most intense lobbying campaigns in history to stop these rules from taking effect. All about derivatives, short sales, and dangerous trading taking place not in banks, broker-dealer, or investment bank departments, but in the federally insured commercial banks they're allowed to own, which are, again, backed by the American taxpayer. The Martin suggests that Solomon makes it sound like his firm's only involvement in derivatives is to help its business customers hedge legitimate risks. But they point out that Goldman itself is taking huge risks in derivatives for its own trading book and is housing those derivatives in its federally insured bank. That's a big deal. And to the office of the Comptroller of the Currency, probably the primary federal regulator of the nation's mega banks. As of June 30th this year, Goldman Sachs Bank USA had $517 billion in assets and, listen to this, $57 trillion in face amount of derivatives with risk-based capital of just under $56 billion. Just four U.S. banks, Goldman, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, and Bank of America, held $193 trillion in derivatives as of June 30th. That's 87% of all derivatives held by commercial banks in the U.S. As the Martins wonder, is there any better definition of insane concentration of risk? I don't know what it is. That nearly $58 trillion in notational derivatives at Goldman Sachs today is more than $4 trillion more than the $53 trillion it held in June 2008, when it and much of Wall Street literally imploded. According to a Federal Reserve audit released in July 2011, from 2007 through at least July 2010, Goldman Sachs received $814 billion in loans from the Fed, much of it, which were below market interest rates of less than 1%. And perhaps as troubling, it received an injection of $10 billion in capital from taxpayers under the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, despite knowledge that it had engaged in multiple frauds in the lead up to the crisis. In short, the Martins warn that the too big to fails want to completely erase any line between a deposit-taking federally insured bank and the so-called trading casinos they run. They note that 4 years after the Great Depression's colossal market crash in 1929, the landmark Glass-Steagall Act was passed by Congress. Among other things, the act created federal deposit insurance for bank deposits and banned Wall Street trading houses from being under the same roof with federally insured banks. Yay. Glass-Steagall, in fact, prevented another repeat of the 1929 crash for the next 66 years. Fortunately, it was repealed during the Wall Street-friendly Clinton administration in 1999. And it took just 9 years after its repeal for the second worst crash in Wall Street history, in 2008. And ever since, the Fed has been bailing out the too big to fails, most of it behind the scenes. In his opening statement at yesterday's banking hearing, committee chair Sherrod Brown of Ohio told the big bank CEOs, quote, "Your game is to try to confuse people. Most Americans probably think of a bank's capital if you force people to think about it at all as money stashed away in a vault, but it's not what it means." Bring back Glass-Steagall, Congress, please. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday. Melody back tomorrow with Butch. Close out the week. Also be on the lookout for our blog and your email inboxes in the morning. Thanks to our production engineer, Todd Waite, and to you for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Bye-bye.